Hey folks, welcome to the Table Podcast. This is a podcast specific re-recording of this past Sunday's talkie bit, November the 29th's talkie bit, which I called Swimming in Common Ground. And yes, that was a deliberate mixing of metaphors. We'll get to that in due course. But I wanted to re-record it partly because the initial one, the live one, was quite long. And probably a bit longish for a podcast, and also because there's a fair bit of content in there that feels like it really would be most at home in the context of the longer term conversations of a community, not private or walled off in some way, just easier for the folks that have been in the conversation for a long time to have nuanced context for, and I think that's important. So all the content from the heart of that talkie bit will be in this podcast, a little bit less of the specific but extemporaneous stuff that was the stuff of community in there. I started with a land acknowledgement, which I usually do, and part of what I talked about in that land acknowledgement I want to include here. I had listened earlier in the week to a William Prince interview. William Prince is a Canadian singer-songwriter, an Indigenous artist, someone who grew up in a Christian context, in a Christian church in northern Manitoba, which was founded by his grandfather and subsequently in which his father had also been a pastor. And so he grew up in the middle of this Christian story as an Indigenous person. And although he wouldn't necessarily identify as a Christian in sort of proper noun sense at this point in his life, as he kind of merges his Indigenous understanding and spirituality and traditions with his Christian history, he's just recorded a new album, and it's gospel music. It's unquestionably Christian gospel songs. And so he was doing an interview with on CBC's Sunday Magazine, Pia Chattopadhyay's show. And she asked him how he could reconcile Christianity as a colonizing force with his commitment to Indigenous teachings in the context of this new album. And Prince said, "I choose to extract the good from the gospel. I wanted to speak on these things because I believe there's good to both." And then he went on to talk about how, as he grows in his own understandings of his traditions and the spirituality of it, of his indigenous self, let's say, he said this, and he said it very gently, but I think it has something for all of us. He said, "Maybe First Nations people are better than some others at holding more than one truth at a time." And then he went on to reference the foundational Indigenous teaching of humility and made the comment that if I know I don't know everything, then there has to be many truths that we don't fully know and understand. And so what it comes down to is respect between different beliefs. And in many ways, that's kind of the space that we're in this talkie bit. And I just thought the way Prince articulated it and the way his story encompassed it was a really great way to set this up. So we're picking up where we left off last week. And if you haven't listened to last week's podcast, I would encourage you to do that. Not something I usually suggest, because strong sequences of ideas that where one is really necessary for the other are not the norm here, and I wouldn't say it's necessary, but I think it could, again, sort of help to add some nuance to this conversation we've begun about common good or common ground and that whole metaphor. Because one of the reasons I would say that the previous week matters is because I want to introduce a different perspective, a new metaphor to our consideration of how we might approach the increasingly obvious and always damaging polarization that surrounds us these days. Let me just say it pretty bluntly. I think we have a collective problem, which we might characterize as the decline of our ability to respectfully disagree, to have civil discourse about discord. We can look at that from lots of different points of view, but in the end, I think they tend to point toward a weakening of our social bonds, to the fraying of the fabric of shared life that we all need in order to be both as well as possible as individuals and as robust as possible as a collective. It's an interesting thing. Statistically, we've never been safer. statistically, we've never been more afraid. And there's a dissonance there that we need to explore and find constructive ways to respond to. Now, as part of last week's talking bit, I was exploring a bit how Jesus' teaching about loving our enemies is one that considerably predates Jesus. This is not an idea unique to Jesus. I want to return for a moment to one of the works that I cited, one of these ancient texts that talks about loving your enemies that predates Jesus' teaching in that regard. And this is from an ancient Egyptian text called the Instruction of Amenemope, which in its original translation is gendered. All humanity is male in the original. I'm going to make that adjustment sort of on the fly, but if you ever look it up, you'll see that difference. So here's what the Instruction of Amenemope says. Row that we may ferry the evil person away, for we will not act according to their evil nature. Lift them up, give them your hand, and leave them in the hands of God. Fill their gut with your own food, that they may be sated and ashamed. Now, I would invite you to just close your eyes for a moment, unless you're driving or walking, you know, doing something where you need to see. But just go into your imagination space for a moment and picture that opening line in a more literal, concrete way for a moment. I don't know if you've ever been in a rowboat before. Lots of people in this part of the world, middle of Canada, haven't. They're not that common here. Maybe a canoe would be a more familiar image. But whatever sort of literal boat we're thinking about that's hand-powered, it's not very big. And so this text, row that we may ferry the evil person away, this is wisdom that places me and you smack in the middle of the same boat as the so-called evil man, evil person, offering them a ride away from whatever troubles they may be causing. This, by the way, is what the word fellowship means. It means fellows in the same ship. Again, the gendered thing is kind of gets in the way here of us thinking as big about this as we should probably, but people together in the same boat is what this is talking about. And then the second image in the wisdom, the instruction of Amenemope, is even more intimate. Lift them up, give them your hand. I'm offering them my hand. I'm lifting them up out of their distress personally. I'm touching them to do it. And the third image has us sitting at the same table sharing a meal that I provided. I'm like, holy bleep, seriously? Why not just have us hugging one another? I mean, it just gets progressively more and more engaged and involved. And the way the saying is constructed, it has this hinge idea in the middle, and it's an overtly spiritual idea. The notion that having my enemy encounter a greater power for good than either of us possesses involves me reaching toward them and pulling them up somehow, rather than putting them down. That's fascinating and powerful and challenging to me. Someone has memorably suggested that loving your enemy isn't something you should try with a tagger. Well, right. No, you shouldn't. That'd be dumb. And as a society, this is one of the functions of our agreed upon laws, to keep the metaphorical tigers, those that can't or won't be helped by this kind of engagement, from running around loose, causing chaos and destruction. These are things that we agree about together as a society. But the idea that there is something worth pursuing here when it comes to dealing with one another as humans, that idea just keeps showing up. And when ideas keep showing up over thousands of years, particularly ideas that challenge us to be kind and to forgive and to reach toward one another and to love one another, they may very well be worth a second look. So if last week was a first look using the metaphor of common ground, this week is a second look using a very different metaphor. And I'm going to share it in a different way than I typically would as well. I'm going to read you someone else's perspective. And this is a perspective I know I would never have gotten to on my own with the tools at my disposal and the perspectives I innately hold. Now, as always, I'm not sharing this from the vantage point of here's the last word, but out of the conviction that we won't make much progress exploring what we believe or growing in our ability to live well with those that believe differently than we do if we never go there. And we increasingly live in a world where we don't have to go there if we don't want to, or we'll just keep getting fed the same perspectives that we already hold. We're all, I think, well informed about this this tilt in our culture. So this is from a perspective that for me was not one of those. It's from a very well-received book called Untamed. The author is someone named Glennon Doyle. Doyle came to renown as a writer with her 2013 memoir, Carry On Warrior, and then the hugely successful 2016 follow-up, Love Warrior. She is someone who has struggled with bulimia and addiction, as well as mental health challenges. She has a well-known TED Talk where she talks about the time she spent in a mental health institution as an adolescent. She's written and spoken very openly about all of that. One of the things her most recent book, Untamed, chronicles is the failure of her first marriage, the salvaging of which is the story she's telling in the first two books, and kind of how she kind of, wins the sort of the battle against her marriage being destroyed by her husband's infidelity. And then along comes this book, Untamed, and it chronicles the failure of that marriage that she had so, in such a celebrated way as an author, sort of saved from destruction. And the chronicle of her meeting and falling in love with former American soccer star Amy Wambach, who is the woman to whom Glennon Doyle is now married, and also of her continued evolution as a person in general, including some of her spiritual shifts. Now, any of you that know me will know that this isn't the kind of author I spend a lot of time with. People that make Oprah's book lists don't tend to necessarily make mine. But I read Untamed, and although I suspect that I probably wouldn't like Glennon Doyle if I met her in person, I think our personalities would really rub against one another. She is a compelling and honest, sometimes brutally honest, teller of the story of her life and the lives of those that she loves. In the section that I'm going to read, she answers a question in a Q&A in a way that I believe speaks quite directly to what we've been exploring. This is from a chapter in her book Untamed called Questions. Recently, I was holding a town hall type event in the Midwest. There were 1,000 women in the audience, a smattering of men, a few gurgling babies. After we opened up the event for questions, I noticed a hand slowly rise in the back of the room. A runner hurried to the back, slid along the pew, and asked the owner of the hand to stand. A woman with short gray hair and a gentle, serious face with deep wrinkles slowly stood. She wore a sweatshirt with an American flag and the word Grandma puffy painted onto it. Her hand shook a little as she held the mic. I loved her instantly. She said, "Hi, Glennon. I've been following your work for 10 years, and I came here to ask you a question that I'm afraid to ask anyone else. I feel confused. My nephew is now my niece. I adore him. I'm sorry, her. My granddaughter took a boy to homecoming last year and a girl this year. And now you're gay too? I don't mean any offense. It's just, why is everybody so gay all of a sudden?" The room fell still and silent. The sea of heads that was turned toward this woman slowly turned back toward me. Eyes were wide. I felt the room's collective stress. For her, for me, for all of us. Oh God, was that offensive? Was that wrong? Is Glennon pissed? But also, why is everybody so gay all of a sudden? They were worried that we'd just crashed and burned. I knew that we'd finally taken off. Blessed are those brave enough to make things awkward, for they wake us up and move us forward. I said, "Thank you for asking a question most are too afraid to admit they have. Unasked questions become prejudices. Your niece and granddaughter are lucky to have you. Will you tell me your name?" "Joanne." "Okay. I do know why everybody's so gay all of a sudden. It's those damn GMOs, Joanne." A wave of relieved laughter washed over the entire church. Some ladies laughed so hard the tears rolled down their faces as we all had ourselves one giant collective organic baptism. When the laughter died down, I suggested that we all take a deep breath. It felt so good to laugh and then breathe together. Everything doesn't have to be terrifying after all. This is just life, and we are just people trying to figure each other out. trying to figure ourselves out. After our breath, I said something like this. There are wild, mysterious forces inside and between human beings that we have never been able to understand. Forces like faith, like love, like sexuality. We're uncomfortable with our inability to comprehend or control these mysteries. So we took wild faith, the mysterious, undefinable, ever-shifting flow between humans and the divine, and we packaged it into religions. We took wild sexuality, the mysterious, undefinable, ever-shifting flow between human beings, and we packaged it into sexual identities. It's like water in a glass. Faith is water. Religion is a glass. Sexuality is water. Sexual identity is a glass. We created these glasses to try to contain uncontainable forces. And then we said to people, pick a glass. Straight or gay? Bracket, by the way, choosing the gay glass will likely leave you unprotected by the law, ostracized by your community, and banished by God. Choose wisely. Close bracket. So, folks poured their wide, juicy selves into these narrow, arbitrary glasses because that was what was expected. Many lived lives of quiet desperation, slowly suffocating as they held their breath to fit inside. Somewhere, sometime, someone, for whatever courageous, miraculous reason, finally acknowledged her dragon. She decided to trust what she felt, to know what she knew, and to dare to imagine an unseen order where she might be free. She refused to contain herself any longer. She decided to speak her insides on the outside and just let it burn. She raised her hand and said, "Those labels don't feel true to me. I don't want to squeeze myself inside either of those glasses. For me, that's not exactly it. I'm not sure what it is yet, but that's not it." Someone else heard the first brave one speak and felt electric hope flowing through his veins. He thought, "Wait, what if I'm not alone? What if I'm not broken at all? What if the glasses system is broken?" He felt his hand rise and a voice rise with a, "Me too." And then another person's hand slowly rose, and then another, and another, until there was a sea of hands, some shaking, some in fists, a chain reaction of truth, hope, and freedom. I don't think that gayness is contagious, but I am certain that freedom is. In the name of freedom, we added more glasses. We said, "Okay, I hear you. Those other glasses don't fit. So here's a bisexual glass for you. And for you, how about a pansexual glass?" And we kept adding labeled glasses for every letter of the LGBTQ until it felt like we'd eventually use up the whole alphabet. This was better, but not exactly right, because some glasses still came with fewer rights and greater burdens, and some people, like me, still couldn't find a glass that fit. My hunch is that folks have always been 50 shades of gay. I wonder if instead of adding more glasses, we should stop trying to contain people within them. Perhaps, eventually, we'll rid ourselves of the glass system altogether. Faith, sexuality, and gender are fluid. No glasses. All see. But letting old structures burn can feel uncomfortable and disorienting. Rumbling freedom is scary because at first it feels like chaos. Pronouns and bathrooms and girls taking girls to prom, oh my. But progress is just perpetually undoing our no longer true enough systems in order to create new ones that more closely fit people as they really are. People aren't changing, after all. It's just that for the first time, there's enough freedom for people to stop changing who they are. Progress is the acknowledgement of what is and what has always been. Progress is always a returning. Maybe we can stop trying so hard to understand the gorgeous mystery of sexuality. Instead, we can just listen to ourselves and each other with curiosity and love and without fear. We can just let people be who they are, and we can believe that the freer each person is, the better we all are. Maybe our understanding of sexuality can become as fluid as sexuality itself. We can remember that no matter how inconvenient it is for us to allow people to emerge from their glasses and flow, it's worth it. Our willingness to be confused, open, and kind will save lives. Maybe courage is not just refusing to be afraid of ourselves, but refusing to be afraid of others, too. Maybe we can stop trying to find common ground and let everybody be the sea. They already are, anyway. Let it be. I'm not going to add very much to that. Just a short story here to give us something to ruminate that in. A couple weeks ago, I made chili for supper. Mom, if you're listening to this, you know how much I love your chili. So just a little context there. The house that I grew up in, if you made chili, and I mean, it had dead animal in it. Like it had meat in it, or it wasn't chili. That's just how it worked. And so the chili I made was vegetarian chili. And I remember the first time I made it, I was sort of thinking, is that a functioning oxymoron, vegetarian chili? Is that like the peacekeeping force of the kitchen, of the menu planning world? But I made it anyway, and it was really, really good. It's become sort of a family fave. I feel like I can say that without spraining my arm, patting myself on the back. It's not my recipe, but we love it, and it keeps showing up. We make it again and again. And here's the interesting thing about that chili. Like lots of things like chilies, soups, stews, it's great right when you make it. It's very tasty. And if you let it simmer for a few hours, it gets even tastier. And the thing about this chili is if you take it off the stove and you put it in the fridge and you come back to it the next day for leftovers, it's even better. And there are just some things that are like that, right? The flavors blend more, it gets more kind of nuanced and complex, and it just gets better, it gets fuller on your palate. Sometimes ideas are like that too. Sometimes we just have to let things simmer for a while to appreciate the savory nature of something that might initially be new to our palate or to our imagination about how a certain thing should be. Doyle ends up talking about sexuality in here a fair bit. Because the question she was asked was about her sexuality in the context of what's going on in the wider culture. But when she discusses these big things about us as humans that challenge us in this way, the things that we try to put into systems, that in her metaphor we put into glasses when they're really meant to be the sea, she talks about sexuality and she talks about faith and she talks about love. I mean, she talks about the big stuff. In a community that exists to explore what we believe, I think this is an intriguing idea. And although we may return to the language of common ground in our ongoing exploration, I think we should continue to sit it alongside the idea that looking for common ground might be one of those things that can give power to those that get to define the ground in a way that's not entirely right and sometimes very wrong. In a way that a metaphor like the sea might be harder to misuse in that way. Anyway, something there to let simmer. That's all I'm going to say about that for now. Thanks for listening. Peace to you all, and we'll chat again soon.